So, Barry and Gary, it's not a joke. Dan's real name's not Larry. We're not part of a cult of rhyming names. However, we have done a lot of work to make sure that you remember who's who, because our experience over talking together has been that during the breaks, people come up and the first question's always, are you Barry or Gary? It's quite embarrassing. So Barry's actually been practicing an Irish accent. He's going to attempt the entire presentation in an Irish accent, so I hope that goes well. Okay, so Lean Enterprise. There's a very cool quote picked up from The Economist to talk about what stops organisations from becoming a lean enterprise. It's quite in line with the theme today. So there are things that go on in traditional organisations that are going to inhibit what you do. And it's really important that we become quite transparent and make these things very visible so that we can change the kind of conversations that are going on in organisations. There's this market tension that's been building. And the first thing we talk about is how do we build the right thing quicker, as opposed to just building the thing that we've been asked to do and continuing to build it until we finished it and then standing back and saying, what do we build next? How do we build the right thing quicker from an end-to-end perspective? So, you know, you can't just build something really, really fast if it takes you sort of 8 months to decide what to build and another sort of 6 or 7 months to actually release it into the marketplace. So how do we create this end-to-end speed, this end-to-end agility, as we call it? The second thing is, how do we increase alignment and decrease fear to be able to manage this change? From an alignment point of view, we're talking about everything within the organization. So the HR contract that dictates what a person can do in their job needs to change. How we fund things by committing all the money up front, and then it all becomes just about how we complete the stuff that we've decided to spend the money on, needs to change. We need to think about, from a leadership point of view, how do you create an environment where it's safe to fail? How do leaders create an environment where it's okay for someone to stand up and say, you know what, this is really not that valuable, we should do something different? Rather than creating KPIs that limit people's ability to do the right thing and actually give you a falsehood of security that we're doing the right thing, because people will always make it look like that we're doing those things to match our KPIs. So how do we make sure that we do that? And how do we better manage risk? Because all the things that Dan talked about, if we're going to have constant change, if we're going to have constant trade-offs, constant decision-making points, how do we do that in a way that reduces risk, creates certainty and predictability? If we don't, there are certain things that we know are going to happen. So decision-making will absolutely slow down. So cycle time, the ability to actually get value into the marketplace, slows down. We start to finish less. I'll talk a bit about this later on, but we're all very good at starting everything and finishing nothing. So how do we start to finish more? It becomes very difficult to validate whether or not we're adding value to the customer. Most organizations I get to work with actually don't even know. They don't bother finding out, because really what happens is we bid for money, we receive money, we build something, we disperse teams, we go and build the next thing. There's no loop. We're not closing any loops. And then lastly, what ends up happening is companies just end up being managed around numbers and measurements like spend, time, completeness. So something has to change. Walking quietly over so that Barry walks the other way.
So we're going to talk on a couple of topics here today. Nice broad-ranging. That was a nice crossover as well, actually.
It was, we did that well that time.
Yeah, it felt good.
High five on the next one.
87%. That's how many companies, the percentage of, in the Fortune 500 that have either been acquired, had to merge, but died in the last 50 years. Survival is no longer mandatory. How do we start to change our organizations to start to adapt to the level of demand that our customers now have from us? I think back to the 80s, IT was seen very much as a cost center. And cost centers are, well, what do we do with them? We drive them down. We take them out of our organization. We outsource them. The capability we have to have in our organizations now to be able to respond to that customer demand, to be able to engage with them. You'll hear loads of great talks today around how technology has become a great enabler for many organizations. I guess my question is, what company isn't a technology company these days? The CIO of FedEx talks about running a technology firm inside a logistics firm. All the information to manage the capability and people and data and decisions that we have to make, how that runs through the fabric of our organization. But bringing this capability back in-house has a lot of ramifications. How do we grow our people? How do they start to learn at the pace that we need to adjust to our customer demands? There's no pink unicorns that can just suddenly rock up to your company and make this happen. It's a big challenge. Growing people in organizations is one of the fundamental challenges that everyone's facing here at the moment, right? The talent war, how do we start to deal with that? Feedback loops are one of the most powerful aspects of every business. Using the information we're learning by performing the work to inform what we will do next. This is the Deming cycle. Plan, do, check, act. Closing that feedback loop helps us inform if we're moving towards the outcomes we want to try and do. Now, unfortunately, what we see in most organizations is just this. Plan, do. Plan, do. Look busy. I think my favorite illustration of this point is actually annual budgeting cycles. So we spend probably 3 months before the budget has to go in, running around, writing this science fiction novel, loosely based on a planet somewhere, a million miles away, beautifully crafted numbers. Now, I know Gary's putting in 5 million, so I better put in 6. But I put in 6 last year, so I put in 7 just so I get some more. And we go into this bidding war scenario, this game playing, that's not based on any real evidence, any real fact, conjecture. And then we spend the next 9 months just working away, making sure we hit the KPIs, hit the numbers, spend all our budget. And then we get to the end of the year and we start the game again, right? But we're not going to talk about what we've delivered, what business outcomes have we achieved this year. I'm going to tell you about next year, because next year is going to be great. We're not challenging ourselves to close these feedback loops, and it's imperative. We have to focus on business outcomes continually. How can we get the work to a size that's manageable, that gives us an opportunity to get a feedback loop with our customers, with the people it's designed for? So a lot of the shoutdowns we get in this is, yeah, it sounds really great, but our organization is different. We're really big, it's really tough, it's quite bureaucratic. So I'd just like to give an example of one organization that's done this fantastically well. Gov.uk, is anyone familiar with it? So talk about an ambitious mission. The UK government decided they were going to create a website, a single touch point for customers. So where customers, that's me, as a citizen, as a civilian even, that's probably a better one. So I can go to this website and find out anything from how do I lodge my tax return, what's the status on pensions in the UK, what are the hospital rights I might have. Single point for customers to interact with every government service. Big mission. So how would you start a project like that? 200 people, 50 million, 15, 16, 25 project streams, all go, let's go. They started with 6 people. 6 people. in a room, co-located, cross-functional, multidisciplinary team to explore, could they even integrate with one of the systems? Could they make a viable solution? Could it even work? Prove the model, then scale out the model. And only when they completed that, in a three-month horizon, they then made an evidence-based decision to invest more, that this initiative could work, that is it a viable solution. They closed their feedback loop around an outcome. Keep that in mind as we go forward today.
So the second thing we want to talk about is value. In Australia, when I go and talk to companies, one of the biggest questions I get asked is, what's value and how do I measure it? Which is really interesting for me, because it just says that you're in business, it's like a fluke. Because value is very simple. It's the thing that customers come to you for. It's the reason they come and actually get something from you. So it's actually not the question people are asking me. They're actually saying, how do I show that I'm being valuable? Which is a very, very different question. I really like this quote, not from anyone overly famous, but it really reflects for me what's going on. Because we can't answer that question, we're optimising organisations around something completely different. So I want to talk a little bit about how we might be able to change some of that. So first of all, how do we focus on high-value items? So one of the organisations I work with, we set out to try and achieve some fairly unique things. How do we create a common language for what value is? So we were trying to work out, how do we get rid of the adversarial situation where you have senior executives trying to sell to each other why their thing is more important than the other thing? So how do you actually compare apples and oranges? How do you work out whether my revenue piece of work is more important than the risk piece of work is more important than the life cycle piece of work? So we needed to find a common language for value. Second thing we're looking at is, how do you maintain your adaptability? How do you make sure we don't lock decisions in for the long term? You know, which is that part about, let's commit up front how we're going to spend the money and spend the rest of our time measuring and reporting on how well we spent the money. How do you create a joint understanding with transparency? The transparency part is really key, because to me this is about trust. So how do you build an environment where everyone starts to understand how important each other's work is? We all start to understand across the enterprise what the most important thing is, whether or not it's my thing or not. I understand that what you're doing is more important than my thing at the moment, so I'm willing to support what you're doing. But create this safety for transparency, where people aren't coming in and trying to sell what they're doing. Rather, we're looking at things in an objective fashion and making appropriate decisions about what the next most valuable thing we can do for the customer actually is. And the last piece, really, really critically, is how do you move forward with imperfect information? So how do you not get bogged down into deep dives? Now, the amount of deep dives that go on in organisations, it just kills me. There's an industry of Excel, right? 20, 30 people going into Excel spreadsheets, crawling through data to answer the same question they were asked 4 months ago, but it's just being asked in a different way. So we've got to go and check it all again. Or because 4 weeks have passed, we've got to go and recheck it because something might be different. So how do we get rid of this constant need for perfection before we make decisions? So what we did is we kind of bastardised a model that was created through both Don Wright's and with Cost of Delay and Dean Leffingwell and Weighted Shortest Job First. And this model basically says, understand customer value. So customer value is value to the customer. That's the external person that's actually paying you money. So understand value to the customer. Understand cost of delay. So that's like, you know, if you're a chocolate factory in March, cost of delay is really, really high. So does value change with time? And then looking at risk and opportunity, which is your internal SWOT. So risk to me might be compliance, opportunity, revenue, that kind of thing. And then underneath, job size. Now, for anyone who's just thought about time, change that. That's not what we mean. What we mean is effort and complexity. it's kind of that ambiguous thing in the middle that, you know, is this thing going to be more complex or harder to do than that thing? And you create a little equation, which gives you a weighted score. It's a really great way to compare apples and oranges, but in this environment, I was trying to do all those other things as well. So what we did is we brought in an agile technique around agile poker. And so what we did is we had a room, there was about 12 people in the room, very, very senior executives, and basically what we would do is put their top five things out on a table. So we had about 40 things on the table at once. And I would say to them, find me the thing that has the least amount of customer value. It's really easy for them to do. It's non-adversarial. There's not a lot of argument. It was actually quite obvious. They'd pick something out, and we'd call that a one. And then I'd pick up the next one, and I'd say, right, compared to this, is this new one a one, two, three, five, or eight? We'll use Fibonacci. And then I'd go three, two, one, and they'd all hold their fingers up. No arguments, no conversations. And we would do that through all of them. If there was a one and an eight, then I'd give that person and that person 30 seconds each to explain why they did that, and we'd re-vote. 3, 2, 1. And we'd get through those 40 in about an hour and a half. Fast, but the key was that we would come back every 2 weeks and review it, which makes it safe to make the wrong decision. So what we would do is we'd use this weighting system, we'd create a weighted backlog, we'd step back, we'd look at it and go, does that look okay? And if it doesn't, we changed it. So we're not, you know, we're not wedded to the number. So if it just didn't look right, we'd make slight adjustments to it. And then 2 weeks later, we'd come back and ask, did any one of these conditions change? If so, we'd rescore. Or was there a new piece of work we needed to look at to score? And that way, we would constantly groom the top 10 to 15 things that were important to us. Then when the capacity came in the organisation to do another piece of work, we'd go straight to that backlog and pick which one we were going to do. The second thing, how do you then work in a way that supports measuring value? Once you understand how you're going to prioritise work, how do you then work in a way that supports measuring if you're delivering value? The single most important diagram. For me, this has been the penny drop. So this diagram says how much money I'm spending and how much value am I delivering in points along the way. So the real question simply became, how did I measure what the blue triangles were? That's all that matters. How do I work in a way that I can measure blue triangles? So there's a couple of things. First one, stoppability. Made it up. It's not a word. It's okay. It's about what it means. Stoppability. Do work in a way that at the end of every blue triangle, I could stop and still have consumed the value that I'd built. All right? It's very common in organisations to build the opposite way. We actually make that happen. It's cultural. So if I build horizontally, if I build this way, once I start, you don't get value till I finish. That means you must give me the money. If I build vertically and deliver you value along the way, and the predictable oh no events happen, you know the ones, you know, November, budget cut, January, hiring freeze, April-ish, increasing EBIT requirement. Now, they happen every year. We just don't plan for them. So if November comes and the budget gets cut and I've built the correct way, who's going to lose the money? It's crazy. So we penalise people for building in a way that enables us to measure value and to deliver value more often. So we have to change that mindset. So this talks about stoppability. It shows us that we can choose the highest value items first. So I can deliver the highest value items first so that the most important conversation that can be had is, when is enough enough? So you can see here, 70% of the money spent, 90% of the value delivered. My gut says, 10% of value left, or I want to spend 30% of my money on it. I should at least have that conversation. Sometimes the answer is yes, because you need that last piece, but I should at least be able to have that conversation. And I should never get past 100-100, which we tend to always do. No more value to be delivered, but we keep spending. So this is critical. We must start to structure our organisations in a way that enable us to measure those blue dots. So what could they be? Well, at the moment, We tend to argue that benefits is a proxy for value. The amount of time those two words get interchanged. What are the benefits? Well, benefits are internal, you know. Cost, utilisation, OPEX, CAPEX, revenue, they're benefits. Now, it's okay to use them as a proxy for value if we have knowledge, but it's rare that we do. And so what we do is we use them, but we end up having these conversations. We've all been part of it, right? A couple of crazy ones I had, one of them just 2 weeks ago, where someone said the words, "We are at risk of not spending our budget." What's the risk? That sounds wonderful. The other one I hear quite often is this one. There's a few people in the room that will nod at me with this one. Which is the next most valuable piece of work we're going to do? Well, it'll have to be CapEx. What? Anything that's CapEx is the next most valuable thing to do. Or something that's going to reduce OPEX. So let's start making decisions on which financial bucket the expenditure is going to come from. To me, that's setting new lows. So we have to think about that. So I just want to give you four quick examples of ways in which I've seen different types of value measure happen. They both have pros and cons. I have a favourite. Hopefully by the end of the four, you'll have one too. First one is earned value. Ugh, it's not value. It's completion percentage. But that's okay. It's actually quite valuable for certain things. Trends. So over on the side here, the dark blue represents capital over 2 years, year one, year two. The light blue represents percentage value, percentage completion. If you have a look at the two, the most important thing to think about is typically what we do is we get close to the end of financial year and work out whether or not we're going to make our numbers. We start to push work over the financial year, guaranteed to make your number, because there's no consequence. If you make your number, there's no consequence. That's all we know. It's all we care about. So what we're trying to do here is create that consequence, make it visible. What this shows you is quite a scary thing, which is whilst we maintain making our number, which is the first year, the drop in the value we're going to deliver as we push work becomes quite visible, and the increased cost in delivering the same amount of value becomes quite visible. So we're creating a consequence of pushing work. Just like with your home budget, if you've got a certain amount of income and you want to spend it on a whole bunch of things, you don't just sit there and go, we'll just push it to next year. You have to make trade-off decisions about what you're not going to spend your money on. And that's what this is about. Working out how to change the conversation, and this worked quite well for me, changing the conversation to not what are we going to delay, but what are we going to not do? What are we actually going to stop? So it's valuable for that. Second one, really like this, very similar to the weighted shortest job first example I gave before, using relative value. But this is at a much more macro scale. So basically this is saying, I take my piece of work that's going to generate $5 million in revenue, and I'll allocate that 5,000 points. I'll pick up my piece of work that's risk and work out, if that's 5,000, what's this? And I'll allocate that a 4,000 or an 8,000 or whatever it might be. And then I give that piece of work to a delivery team, and they break that work down like a hierarchy into smaller pieces of work, and they'll allocate out to those smaller pieces a percentage of those points. That gives me my blue dots. And then as they complete one of those pieces of work, I'll claim those points as value. Now, it's not quite right, but it's a great way to make quick decisions. It gives you an indicator of what you think you might do. But you need one more. You need the extra piece, which is actuals. So if you're going to do that, the relative, you must go back and do actuals. Because the big negative of actuals is time lag. So if you compare the two, it's actually quite good. I can use the first one to get really quick information, move forward with imperfect information. The second one, I've got to go back and check my actuals. The interesting thing about that is the cone of uncertainty. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the cone of uncertainty, but it basically says that knowledge or the gap between actuals and relative starts like this and then over time does this until actuals nearly equal relativity. And that happens as people's learning together goes on, and that's why with weighted shortest job first, it's really important to have the same people in the room learning together and getting that joint understanding. The other thing around using your actual benefits, though, is it's just open for gaming, right? And that's where the benefits bit becomes quite ugly. We change that conversation. A great example, so You know, if you're in a call center environment, we've got handling time, so people look to reduce average handling time. We do work to reduce handling time. And we do work to reduce call transfers as well. So those two things are diametrically opposed, right? So what we do is we do the two pieces of work, and then when do we claim benefits? Well, we do a piece of work that reduces call transfers. How do we do that? We increase average handling time. We do a piece of work to reduce average handling time. How do we do that? We increase call transfers. And we claim at the trough. So it looks like we've done the right thing, and it looks like we've reached the benefits. But of course, in reality, we can't prove if the piece of work that we did had any impact on those two things whatsoever. So it's open to that. The last one, customer value. So this is the only one that is really value. It's the only one. There's a couple of problems with it. It's really difficult to find out what's valuable to the customer and actually see whether or not you did that. Every time you do it, it's a different answer. So the metric isn't standard across the company. You can't have a single customer value metric. You've actually got to know what every customer engagement is and what's valuable to them. And the most important thing of all, in answer to the question I keep getting asked, is what's value and how do we measure it? Value is not a volume measure. Value is a yes-no measure. Did I or didn't I? Great example. So if I'm in the finance industry, in fact, I was in the finance industry talking to a CIO, and the CIO said to me, I know what customers want from us. I understand customer demand. I said, oh yeah, what is that? 70% of our customers want a mortgage. Hands up, who wants a mortgage? So they don't, they want a home. And so we had this great conversation after that about what if we could get everyone in the organisation, in this bank, that had something to do with giving customers a home and put them together and made them measure the amount of homes they gave every day. Imagine the customer job satisfaction of employees walking home at night thinking about how many homes they gave as opposed to how many mortgages they sold. That's the difference between understanding customer value and measuring benefits. Mortgage, benefits. Home, value.
So how can we start to answer that question of customer value? Yes, no. It's an empirical answer. So the best way to do that is to actually create an experiment. And then do that experiment with the people it's designed for. How can we drive experimentation with our customers into our day-to-day life? How can we make it simple, safe, and quick to give us the best answer of what we are doing, if it's actually valuable? So Gary was talking a little bit earlier about when he got all his execs in the room, and they qualitatively try to decide what's valuable. Then they would identify a piece of work to execute to test with their customers if that was actually valuable, and then use the information they've learned from performing the work to make that pivot, preserve, or stop decision. Have we done enough? So by moving decisions to experiments, especially with our customers, we can really start to make progress, especially when innovating and doing new pieces of work. And it's a fundamentally different type of approach than sitting there with a business case when someone's come up with a new idea and just written it down versus demonstrable evidence from a piece of work you have performed with your customers that shows that they find it valuable. Fundamentally different things. Optionality, then, is also very important. So think about how investment bankers run portfolios. They don't make one or two bets for the year. They make lots of small bets. And then they limit losses and ramp up successes. We should be running our projects, our work, our product development exactly the same. How can we create those small batches, deliver something valuable, and then measure if it's actually achieving a business outcome that's worthy of further investment? Organizations need to also look at their portfolio. The success of today does not guarantee the success of tomorrow. The business models that are generating most of your revenue in your organizations today, how relevant will they be 2 years' time, 5 years' time? You saw Dan talk about the kind of disruption. Your competitors, where are they coming from? It's not the person sitting beside you anymore. It's a kid in Nebraska with $1,000 on a credit card, and they've come up with a new idea. You can't buy all of them. You can't acquire them all. So starting to understand how you start to manage this horizons of what's working for today, tomorrow. What's dangerous is not to evolve your business. So is playing it safe really safe? Intuit are a very interesting company. They run probably most of the payroll for small to medium-sized businesses in the US. They also offer accountancy packages for individuals. I think they've created one of the best products I've ever seen in my life. And it's all focused around their customers. They were told, the team can't build this. It's impossible. Never going to happen. I want you to go on to the iStore or Google Play. Have a look for SnapTax. Never in my life have I seen customer responses. So when the team set out to prove this product, how do you think they measured success? So the product is, I pull out my tax return, I take out my phone, I take a photo of it, and it does my tax return straight away. Done. When they were building the product, their KPI was called Love Metrics. How much do customers love this product? Not ROI, not velocity. How much do customers love this product? Go look at the App Store. Great, you'll see there. And they designed their whole business around this. So they look at horizons in terms of investment. 60% of their portfolio looks at Horizon 2. Horizon 1, 30% on Horizon 2, and then 10% investment on the third horizon, the success for the day after tomorrow. Managers are actually measured on new customers and revenue for products created in the last 3 years. So they design innovation into their framework for managing their business. Another company who's fantastic at doing this is 3M. It's part of the culture, it's part of the fabric. They want to experiment with their customers, use them to drive the right product to build.
The next piece we want to talk about was, how do you then maximize the flow of value through the company? How do you structure your organization in a way that enables that to happen? And minimize the handovers. So there's kind of two ways to look at organizational structure. There's this traditional method of hierarchically aligned. So hierarchically aligned, you know, we have management structures and people report to people and the work gets given to somebody. The way it typically happens, though, is that people bid for work. So because of the line of business that I am and the people that work for me, we want to do this kind of work and we go up and we bid for it. It's really counterintuitive to doing the work that is aligned to customers, the work that's aligned to value. Because what happens when that changes? what typically happens today is that we start to go into a panic about things like stranded workforces, you know, stranded labour, idle staff. And to avoid that, we actually start looking for work for those people, which makes them busy and keeps up their utilisation. We get to maintain our empires. So the counterintuitive. So one of the things that comes out of hierarchically aligned organisations is a real disjointed KPI metrics, really disjointed structures. I was really fortunate to sit in a call centre late last year, and I plugged in next to the number one call centre agent in the call centre. You always know that, right? Because there's like ladders up on the wall and, you know, charts of success. And this guy was number one on top of the ladder. And a customer called in and said, look, I've just received contact from your competitor. They've offered me a really good deal, but I'm very loyal to you. I just want to know if you could do me a better deal. And this guy, perfect, you know, in all of his scripting, looked up that customer's account and said, yep, absolutely. I can see here that we can absolutely do you a better deal. I'll have someone call you on Friday. This was Tuesday. And then true to form, following the script, he followed up with, is there anything else I can help you out with? Customer frustratingly said, but why has it taken for your competitor to call me, for me to then call you to find out that you can do me a better deal, and now you want me to wait 4 days to actually find out what that is? Click. Hung the phone up. This guy ripped off his headset, smashed it against the wall, stormed off in a huff. Went after him, sat down, had a coffee. I said, what happened? Why did that take place? He said, very simple. I'm only paid to give leads. It would have taken me 15 minutes to help that customer and give them what they wanted, and I'm judged on average handling time. How does that happen? How do we get to that point? Hierarchically aligned organisations do that because KPIs are really about individual business units and individual people. Customer line is very different. So think this through. What we can do, if we understand demand intimately, we understand what customers want from us. We can then observe that and understand the diversity that exists in the type of work we need to do, we would naturally form groups of people. It's not about numbers. So I've been involved in doing this with groups of 100 and groups of over 500. So it's not about numbers of people. So we have naturally formed groups of people around diversity of work. If I understand that diversity of work, I can then start to think about how many teams do I need to have within each of those groups. And that's very simple because we can start to look at a lowest common denominator. So if each one of these groups shared a common backlog of work, what's the lowest common denominator in that work that would tell me how many teams I can have? So an example that I had, again, I'm using another call centre environment. So this group worked on IVRs and all the call queues and the routing technologies. And there was a technology in there called CTI, which is quite a rare skill set. So in this group of about 140 people, there was only 8 people who had that skill set. So we created 9 teams. Every one of the teams had one, except for one team, which we then prioritised work that didn't require that skill set into that team. Then what we did is when one of those teams pulled from the backlog a piece of work that they were not capable of doing, so each team was structured to be able to complete about 70% of the backlog. So if we're in that 30% range, they would then reach out to anyone in the organisation that had the skill to do that kind of work as a subject matter expert who would come and teach them how to do it. And they would reach out to another team within their group and grab someone from there who would come and do that work with them, learn it, and then take it back to their team. So you also start to build a learning organisation as you go. This model works. That particular team now delivering work 3 years later at about half the cost of what we're delivering the same amount of work at the start. And they've evolved greatly since those days. The work structures are different, the team's different, because if you continue to watch demand, as it changes, your work will change, your people need to change. It is unbelievably difficult for middle management to get their heads around it. How do I do PRDPs? How do I do development plans? How do I tell people what work to do? Very, very hard to get their heads around, but this is clearly the way you need to go to bring more adaptability into your organisation.
So We've just touched on a few themes today. We wanted to sort of get the creative juices flowing with everyone. Our friends at Vodafone are going to come next and speak about the culture change they've experienced from going through a recent initiative, I think, which is really interesting. Like Apple, we're kind of happy with the things we were able to leave out today, rather than the things we tried to put in. But it's really important for us that you feel you can leave today with some actionable stuff. What am I going to go and do tomorrow? How can I start to address some of these challenges that we've identified at the top of the piece? Reflect on that question.
You can start there. So we've got four things. It doesn't mean go and do all of them, but maybe pick one and have a crack. First one is go and get knowledge. Go and understand demand. Understand what customers really want. The only way to do that is to follow the work. So either pick a customer engagement or pick a product or maybe pick a project. Actually go in there yourself. Ignore the management meetings. Ignore the status reports. Ignore word-of-mouth updates. Go and find out what's going on. Go and learn the constraints in your organisation that are stopping that flow of value. Because that call centre manager, the manager of that agent, didn't have a clue that that was what was going on. Certainly the senior executive team that I was in there with didn't have a clue that the KPIs they put in place were causing that kind of outcome. So go and understand that so you can see for yourself what's really going on. The second one, make the work visible. True visibility depersonalises work. It makes it about the work rather than the people doing it. It makes decisions obvious. It helps build trust because it's so obvious that there's no use having that game, the adversarial game. Everybody can see what needs to be done. These are two examples. That first example is an early shot of the team I was talking to you about and what we did there. And what you can see there in the colour-wise, we framed the work, so that anyone who didn't know what we were doing could come to the wall and actually walk through it and understood by the end of that wall exactly what we'd achieved, what we're going to do next, what the value was that we were working on. This one's quite a new one. It's blurred deliberately. But why I wanted to put it on there is the blue sticky notes you can see there are actually a team of people thinking about the work going on in IT and understanding the work going on across the business, so the big business objectives, and how the work in IT is enabling each one of those things to happen. It's kind of like a mind map, but what it's done is it's brought the most senior people to come to that wall and interact with it, and the knowledge that everybody's gaining by people walking up and moving things around, saying, no, that's not quite right, we've got to do this bit first, and then that's going to happen, and then we're starting to build out this incredible map of FY15 and the kind of work that we're going to do and what order it needs to be done. So that when we have trade-off conversations, the conversations aren't about let's just order less kit, let's not have as much storage, let's not create or build as much hardware. We're actually looking up the top and saying what is the business trying to achieve and what trade-offs do we need to make about how we go about achieving that given the constraint of money that we have. So it's a completely different conversation. So making the work visible isn't just about building walls, it's actually about the way people will come and start interacting with those walls and the way decisions start to become a lot easier to make. The third one, let's try and find out what these blue triangles mean. So understand the value conversation you need to have in your organisation. Let's work out what value is and how you can start to structure your organisation to start to knock off and understand when you're delivering value more often.
And then how do you mark those triangles? So driving your decisions into experiments as close to your customer as possible. The smaller, the tighter, the faster the feedback loops, the higher the fidelity of information you're going to get to help you make those informed value decisions. And if they're small, if they're short, it's safer. It's safer to fail because we'll learn fast. So the most dangerous thing you might take away today is that some of these ideas, they're not going to work in our organization. We're too big, we're too bureaucratic. It's just too tough. But I challenge you to listen to all the stories you're hearing today. Listen for the principles behind the narratives, the storytelling. Not everything's going to work in your organization, but you need to start experimenting in a way to learn for yourself what will. And then maybe next year, you might be up here sharing how you created a lean enterprise by engaging with your customers and driving real business change in your organization. Thanks very much. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
First of all, thank you. It was very interesting. I find that if I will go back to the beginning where you divided everything to try to assess it based on the customer value, business benefit, and so on, I'm finding myself currently handling similar issues, facing similar questions as you put on the table, and sometimes it's simply impossible to give a business value, and I want to give you an example to get your point of view. So right now, in the past few months, what we're focusing on is a development of a new website. Part of it included basically looking into better methodologies so the website will be responsive, therefore means that we can use it whatever platform we want. As we were looking onto it, we noticed that the current technologies that people are using are quite limiting, and therefore I created a certain theoretical model that challenged the concept of a bootstrap to try to do things differently. We filed a provisional patent, and at the moment it's pending. And now basically we have 1 year to do a proof of concept. And the business is asking me, what is the benefit? And you cannot quantify intellectual property. So I can follow that through and I can do something, and as a result, it can go everywhere and give the business a lot of prospect, or it can do nothing. I can pull numbers and, well, I don't know any other term, but pull numbers out of my ass.
Do what everyone else does, yep.
But that is simply lying. And I can give more and more example, but I think there is certain instances that you have a task, you have a challenge, that there is no way to actually quantify it, either from a customer or from a business. And how do you handle a situation like that?
So you've actually got two problems. So the first problem is the problem where I talked about at the start, that kind of sandwich in the middle. There's no speeding up and being innovative in one part of the organization. If you're still getting asked those kind of questions, the problem's further up. So there's a problem you need to go and solve where executives are saying, quantify me the benefit before I do anything. You know, I've just had the same thing where someone said, I want to know 15 months in advance in a roadmap, because we're trying to do planning, what you're going to build, what the benefit's going to be, what it looks like, and if you can't give me that detail, I can't give you the money. So that's the problem, not trying to then work out how to prove that that's true. You've got a bigger problem that needs to be dealt with. The second part I'd say to you is, it all comes down to what you measure. All right? So understanding what to measure is the critical thing that people need to work out. And for me, there's sort of two aspects to it. So if I was in charge of money and I wanted to be fiscally responsible, I would give money to anyone who can prove that the benefit exists. What we've just got to change is that I would also give money to anyone who thinks there's benefit but doesn't know and needs to go and find out. It would just be a much smaller piece of money. So it's that cultural change. If I come to you and say, I can prove because I've been measuring call rates and I've been doing this work that if we do this, this thing's going to happen, great. If I can prove that, no problem. I mean proof, I don't mean fictitious numbers. If I can prove it, then that's worth giving the $250,000 for the next 6 months, go and do that. If I don't know, but it just feels like a really good idea, I should respect that and go, okay, well, here's 20, 30, 50, go and find out. And once you've proved it, come back and we'll give you the other 200. So there's two changes that need to happen. One's got to happen up here about what questions get asked, and then secondly, culturally, how we approach doing work needs to change.
A cultural change is a big thing.
Big thing.
Well, that's what Vodafone are going to talk about shortly, right?
Are there any other questions for Barry and Gary?
Okay, we'll be around, so if anyone wants to have a cup of tea and...
Cup of tea?
Yeah.
See, everyone now knows that the accent's true.
Please join me in thanking Gary and Gary again.